right. In Matthew 25, we find this parable of the sheep and the goats among several other parables, in fact. Now that works. The chapter itself is going to just be picking up really what started back in chapter 24. A lot of this Matthew teaching, I don't know exactly when you would break up, like on what day did this event happen, at what point in the day, you know, how much lapse was there in between. You have, like in chapter 24, verse 1 or verse 3, you have a couple of mentions of being in different places, and so you assume that some time maybe passes in between those things. But in 24, verse 3, you have a question that's asked about what he had just said in verse 2, so you'd figure, well, that must not have happened very long after that. At the beginning of chapter 24, there's just not a mention of a whole lot of time passing. It may have been days, but it's not said. All that to say, I don't know how far back this speech of Jesus would have gone, at least back to chapter 24 and verse 4, though, because then you have all kind of a unified block of teaching that is given, or is instigated at least, by some specific questions that the disciples had. This chapter 24 deals with, I have in parentheses there, at least the destruction of Jerusalem. I don't want to spend the class talking about Matthew 24. It's not where our parable is. It's ripe for discussion. There are a lot of wonderful, useful things to take out of there. There's also a lot of trips out into the weeds that you can take if you begin looking at that chapter very long. My personal view of it, at least now, it's changed a few times back and forth, probably in the last 5 years, I would have to admit to, but I think it most likely that Jesus is answering maybe two separate questions, or is answering one question and then going into a different topic. First answering to an immediate coming of the Son of Man, or coming of God, which is a judgment physically upon the nation of Israel, upon Jerusalem, which would be accomplished in the year AD 70. And then goes on to give some information about what we think of as the second coming, the real end of everything, and that period of judgment. I think there is some notes about maybe a subtle shift into looking at a separate or kind of an additional application of those things. The short form of this, though, is that he is telling the disciples about judgment, whether that is only looking at near term or if that's looking at any time you are going to see God visiting man to reward them for their deeds, good or ill. And a theme emerges, especially towards the end of chapter 24, because the disciples are told that you won't really know when this is coming. That was the initial question they asked, wasn't it? If you go back at the beginning of chapter 24, verse 3, when will these things be? What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? That's what they wanted. Tell us the sign that we can look for so we'll know what to expect and when to expect it. And the answer Jesus gives sort of answers that a little bit. I've long thought if he was meaning to answer that very decisively, it's not a great information-filled answer if he's trying to nail down a specific for them. How will you know? You'll hear of wars and rumors of wars, and there will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines. Nation will rise against nation. Okay. Well, then we know exactly when that's going to happen, because that was one specific time in history, right, where there's been war and rumors of war and earthquakes and all those sorts of things. So even the beginning answer that Jesus gives seems a little bit nebulous, but he does go on to give some more specific information, like beginning in verse 15. But all this ends up kind of settling on the idea that even though you might see a specific sign immediately preceding what is about to happen, you don't really know when that sign is going to appear. And by the time the sign appears, there may not even be that much time to act on the information you're receiving. And so you need to be ready all the time. This verse 44 of that chapter is really kind of getting to the heart of that theme that I'm talking about. You also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. There's an element of surprise. There is an element of man not having the ability to prepare himself on the spur of the moment. And so the need, the encompassing need then becomes you get ready now. You prepare ahead of time. And so really that's what chapter 5 continues along that theme of preparation for judgment, being ready, being equipped, because there is going to come a time of accounting, a time of reckoning. And so chapter 25 has these three parables that follow that kind of keep building up to a more specific answer. You have the parable of the wise and foolish virgins in the first 13 verses of chapter 25. That's really telling them you need to be preparing now while you can. After the bridegroom comes and if you're trying to get your lamps ready and trying to go gather the oil that you would have needed all along, and you try to do that when he shows up, it's too late. You're going to get stuck outside. You're not going to be able to participate. So you need to be preparing now. All right, well, how? How do we get ready now? What do I actually need to be doing to do that? So then you see the parable of the talents. Well, now you have men who are, their master leaves and tells them to do business, and he'll kind of collect on that when he returns. We looked at the parable of the talents, or I guess we looked at the parable of the pounds, very similar one a couple of months ago. But that kind of answers the how question. Well, you use what God has given to you. You stay busy. You stay diligent in service to God. You make good on the things that he's invested in you. Be a faithful steward. Be a good servant. Well, then that leads us to the question, all right, good principle. That sounds like something we should be doing. What does that look like in practice then? What would that actually be like in real life if we were following that principle of using what we have in service to God? And so then we have this parable of the sheep and the goats, and the comments that follow that I think largely answer that question. All right, let's read this section, actually. I know I didn't have a lot of time to, I don't think I even put up the text on screen last week to get you all ready for what we were looking at tonight, and I apologize for that. So let's go ahead and read it together so that we are on somewhat familiar ground at least. Begin in verse 31, Matthew 25. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the holy angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them from one another, as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. And he will set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on the left. Then the king will say to those on his right hand, "Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me." Then the righteous will answer him, saying, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and come to you?" And the king will answer and say to them, "Assuredly, I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these my brethren, you did it to me." Then he will also say to those on the left hand, "Depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not take me in. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick, and in prison, and you did not visit me." Then they also will answer him, saying, "Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister to you?" Then he will answer them, saying, "Assuredly, I say to you, inasmuch as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me." And these will go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. So the image that Jesus uses to begin this section is that of a kind of a mixed flock or a mixed herd. You've got sheep and goats, which was and still is a common thing to have both of them together during the day, at least, and then they might be separated out at night. They have kind of different needs or different preferences, I guess. Sheep and goats do. Sheep, as I understand it, are a little bit more comfortable staying out at night, staying out in the pasture, and it's kind of safe to do that if you please. And then the goats might need to be brought in, especially in a colder climate, don't deal as well with the cold maybe. And so it might be at the end of the day or at the end of every couple of days, you'd have this kind of sorting process taking place where you're going to go and divide right and left and give to each as they need. Not a whole lot to just dwell on here, but those sheep being put on the right, they're the ones who are blessed. That just kind of makes sense with the imagery we tend to get of sheep biblically, often a sign for Israel, the flock of the Lord, and he is the shepherd, and it's usually the sheep that is mentioned. Goats are also kind of seen as being more wild and a little bit just not as valuable oftentimes, and just maybe not as preferable as a sheep would be. And so you get right hand and left hand that way. I will note right now, we'll look at some of the kind of secondary applications in a little bit, but one of the underlying ideas behind this might be that it would be an easy thing for a sheep to sort out good and bad. In the same way with some of the parables that we looked at before, like the parable of the dragnet, and then he sorts out the fish. You know, this one's good, can be sold in the market. This one isn't. We got to do something else with it. For the experienced fisherman, just like the experienced shepherd here, it's not a long, lengthy process of each one's going to come by and he's going to have to stare at that animal for a long time and come over here, and he's going to have to look under his hooves and just kind of start turning him over and get a blood test and try and figure, is this a sheep or a goat? I don't know what we've got here. And it's almost impossible to tell. Who could know? He knows as soon as he sees him. All right, you're a sheep, get over here. You're a goat, get over here. And it's just going to be a very clear, obvious distinction to make. And in much the same way, we're going to get a lot of that from these ideas that Jesus uses in this parable and similar ones. If you're not for me, you're against me. It's a very clear line of distinction. There isn't just a whole lot of discussion about the matter, kind of. To the Lord, it is an obvious thing whether or not we are standing for him, whether or not we are blessed or cursed. So, the purpose behind this, why are we... What point are we going to be able to take away from this? Comments, questions on this, the root of the matter. What do we seem to be looking at with the primary point here that Jesus is getting at?
Works.
Sorry?
Works.
Okay, it's very clear from this that there's a lot of importance placed on what we're doing. Isn't there? We'll talk in a little bit. This is not to contradict anything that Paul would have written or anything that would say, this is not advocating for being saved by being a nice person, by being a helpful person, but it does guard against going so far in the other direction, doesn't it? That says, well, if you're saved by faith or by grace or whatever it might be that we would look at in place of kind of the whole picture of salvation, well, what you do doesn't matter. God just kind of isn't going to look at that side of things. Well, he's obviously invested in what his people do. He is going to, as he will say oftentimes, judge you by your deeds. I will hold you accountable for what you do, is a huge takeaway from this. Yeah, Brother Garen.
Mm-hmm. And here Jesus is going to explain to them as best he can about all of that. Now,
yeah.
It's going to be a little vague in finality, but I think there has to be a reason for it. I personally think there's a big shift of gears in verse 24 and verse 36. It looks to me like that is a different time than the first part.
I'm I would be right there with you on that point, chapter 24, verse 36, kind of 35 leading into to 36. I agree. Brother Guerin is saying there, this is the Lord's way of giving a kind of an explanation, you know, the kind of program, I guess, almost, of judgment. What's that going to be like? What's that going to look like? What do you need to be thinking about in light of that reality? He's explaining that scenario to them. He begins by using a familiar image, which he does a lot of times to explain important concepts. But it is that jumping off point to explain a very big topic. I guess that's underselling it to say the final judgment is something of importance. But yeah, Steve. Okay.
And so there's not pleading your case before Christ in the judgment. You have to be ready when it comes.
Okay. Good point. I like that. It's kind of set in stone when it comes time for the separation. You're going to go into this group or you're going to go into that group. There's not, goat couldn't get a special exemption form to be able to go onto the sheep side. It's just going to be clear which way you go. David. Yeah.
Bad trees produce bad fruit.
Yeah.
These works are not random. They're obedience.
Okay. And we'll talk about that in a moment. What are the works actually showing? Why are they there? What are they the result of? All those questions kind of inform why he is placing such a prominent emphasis on them, because they do show something. So that will be very important to remember. Did I see another? Eva. Okay. All right. Very good point. And I'm going to emphasize that more in a moment. If you couldn't hear Eva, she mentioned some ideas from chapter 24, where there is a bit of an emphasis from Jesus on listening to those who are warning about this judgment. She mentioned Noah, and he'll talk about those who are kind of explaining and proclaiming that the end is coming, and so you need to be ready. I do think that has a lot to do with what he's getting at here in chapter 25. All right, and continue to stop me if you have comments, questions, but I'll put up kind of what I'm thinking here. As we've said, the actual parable section here is very short, really just those two lines. You have sheep, and from that point on, they're not referred to as sheep or goats. They're clearly people, and you've got a king talking to them instead of a shepherd, so he's being kind of fluid with the imagery that's in use. But it does serve to illustrate what we have talked about there, this very decisive act of separation that is going to take place. The picture here that he is giving, with no exceptions, he says, all the nations will be gathered before him for this judgment. And this will be the final, you know, irrevocable, punctuated point where there is judgment, and as we've said, that just it's not going to be reversed, it's not going to be overturned. That is going to be the final answer. And so, with the remainder of that story, Jesus is kind of giving some information about the standards that will be used for that judgment. He has talked a little bit about that before. I mean, you could say the same thing about the parable of the talents to a degree. This seems to delve more into some specifics, though. The criteria that we see is spelled out for the first time beginning in verse 35. Verses 35 and 36, give the general template of those six acts, really six deeds that he has in mind. They are going to be emphasized heavily throughout the text, aren't they? I mean, you noticed when we read that together, they're repeated four times. Jesus says them to the first group, and then they repeat them back to him, and then he says them to the second group, and they repeat them back to him. You get four chances to hear what's he looking at, what are we talking about when we're looking at fitness for the kingdom prepared from the foundation of the world. If you look in Ezekiel 18, we're not going to spend just a ton of time on that, but Ezekiel 18 is a kind of similar setup, isn't it? He is talking about who is going to have life, what soul will actually live before the Lord. And he mentions several things. He begins just with the blanket idea of doing what is right, and those who listen to the Lord doing what is right. And then he talks some about idolatry. But then he goes on to mention some things that sound very similar to what Jesus is drawing on here. You haven't stolen from the poor and those who are hungry, but you've given them food. You haven't taken from those who don't have anything, but you've clothed them. You've actually given them what they need. So it's a very similar setup. Whether or not you stand or fall before God's judgment is dependent on what you have done, what you have chosen to do with the opportunities that you have to serve others. They end up making kind of similar points in that regard. I do want to note a specific thing with this, though, because the targets of that ministry, look there for the first time in verse number 39, no, excuse me, verse 40. He says that after they question, of course, these good sheep who have just done their acts of service, apparently the feeling you get is that they've done that kind of without a thought of needing to be repaid for them, don't you? They have just done that because they are loving, because they are obedient, because they're good. And so they're kind of charmingly perplexed at what the king is saying to them. You know, we would have done those things for you, Lord, but I think you're mistaken. We didn't do that. I want to make sure. It's kind of like the person who gets too much change at the register and they go back and say, no, you gave me a 20 back and it was only supposed to be a $1 bill. And you say, well, thanks for correcting the error. I mean, here they're coming to the king and saying, thank you, but we didn't do that. Well, his response to them, though, is that inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. And when we find Jesus using those, especially that language in Matthew's gospel, when he talks about my brethren, I've got a couple of references for that on the screen, Matthew 12 and again at chapter 28 when he's sending people to go talk to his disciples. That's who he's talking about when Jesus uses that phrase, when he's talking about my brethren. They're his disciples. Maybe we could say even more specifically the apostles. But this gives this passage, that idea makes us feel very similar to what Jesus had also said back in chapter 10. And bear in mind, I mean, all of this is within Matthew's gospel. This is all within the same story that he's telling. Look what Matthew had said back in chapter 10 and verse 40. This is when he's getting ready to send the apostles out and is giving them some instructions or some warnings kind of about what that will be like, what they should anticipate facing, I think, in the immediate time when he's sending them out, but also after I am resurrected and after I ascend, and when it's you going out into all the world to preach the gospel, here's what you can expect. He gives them some instructions about their conduct. But look how he finishes that section, chapter 10, verse 40. He who receives you receives me, and he who receives me receives him who sent me. He who receives a prophet in the name of a prophet shall receive a prophet's reward. And he who receives a righteous man in the name of a righteous man shall receive a righteous man's reward. And whoever gives one of these little ones only a cup of cold water in the name of a disciple, assuredly I say to you, he shall by no means lose his reward. That passage sounds very similar to what we are looking at in chapter 25, doesn't it? The idea of finding one who is a prophet or who is one of the least of these, who is one of my brethren, who is a disciple, and receiving him, giving him a cup of cold water, treating him well, showing him love, showing him kindness because of the fact that he is a righteous man. I think a similar passage in Mark, makes that a little bit clearer, or maybe just different translations of Matthew 10 do as well. Here it's, you know, in a prophet's name. Sometimes you'll see the statement, because he is a prophet, or something along those lines, which is showing that, again, Jesus is not just talking about, you'll be saved because you're a nice guy. You'll be saved because you did good things to people. That isn't the sole criteria that he's looking at there. Specifically in chapter 10, what he's saying is, those who do something good for you because you came from me, they'll have a blessing in that. Those who were kind to you because you were a prophet and listened to what you said because they knew you were a prophet of God, that leads to their being blessed. And it's a similar idea here in chapter 25 then. I think that same principle is at work. He who receives you receives me, and now it's, when you did this for the least of these, you did it for me. So, putting that together then, I'd say what we find in Matthew 25 is not just a judgment that rests solely on performing acts of kindness. Just go out and clothe the hungry. Just go out and clothe the hungry. Is nice, I guess. They don't need the clothes. Give the clothes to the people who don't have the clothes. Give the food to the hungry. Just go out and do all those good things. Just help everybody in the world, and that's what God is looking at for us to be saved. I don't think that's the point that he's driving at. Rather, what do those signs show? The same thing that they showed in Matthew 10. You give a cup of cold water to one who comes from me, a disciple, because he's a disciple. That's what I'm looking for. And so here in Matthew 25, when you've got these sheep who have found those, and notice that there is, I mean, it could just be talking about that they do this for each other, but it is a different group of people, or different titles at least, that are associated with them. You begin with the sheep that he's talking to, and then you have him talking about what you did for my brethren, which is somebody else. Again, it could be just within the same group, but it seems more specifically applied to the people who have proclaimed the gospel to you, the people who have come in my name and have tried to make you a disciple so that you can follow me. Well, how have you treated them? You were good to them. You looked after them. And that is showing your acceptance of not just them, but their message. And therefore, not just them, but me, is really what Jesus is telling them. All of those acts of kindness work on a deeper level to show that they're not just nice people. They're people who accept Christ. They're people who listen to his gospel and have responded to that message. Brother Garen. Sure.
If you can't do what these people are doing that are working the little ones, you can support them. And that's the important point that I see.
Yeah. No, good point there, and a good connection to what we'd find elsewhere, that this isn't something that we're going to need to accomplish in a few days and then sit down and wait. There is an ongoing component to this kind of service, this kind of readiness in his kingdom that he's talking about. Other comments, other points along those lines. We see what we're looking at here. Eva.
Do nothing from selfish ambition.
No, I think that's a good point. The idea of not, and we mentioned a minute ago, just kind of these acts of service weren't performed with a mind to collect on that later on, were they? They are performed to the least. If you go back to Matthew 10 and kind of see what he is telling his apostles to do and to prepare for, he tells them, like back in verse 9, to not have gold or silver or copper, to not have all these supplies and get everything ready so that you can be self-sufficient on the road. They're going to be relying on the kindness of other people when they go out and do that, aren't they? So the people who are showing that kindness, they have to know, well, I'm not doing this so that he can pay me back later. And that's clearly the attitude that we get from these sheep here in Matthew 25. When the Lord says, I'm going to reward you for what you've done to the least of these, my brethren, they don't say, good, finally, because, you know, I waited around for years and he didn't ever pay back what he owed me, did he? No, they say, okay, good, we weren't expecting this. What a boon. They had just performed that with no thought of repayment. Proverbs 19 and verse 17, a good proverb in connection with this parable, I think. He who has pity on the poor lends to the Lord, and he will repay what he has given. That's the idea here. It is performing for another as though we are performing for God and showing our love of him in that way. David. Yeah. Sure. It has to be motivated by knowledge of what that means. Why am I doing this? What is the point of this? And here for these people, as it would in Matthew 10, I know I keep kind of going back and forth between the two. It seems clear why that is happening. It's because their knowledge of God, their acceptance of what he is showing to them. Steve.
These are examples of passion one to another. It makes me think of love your neighbor as yourself.
Yeah.
I think I didn't quite catch what you said earlier about this. The first part is my brothers.
Mm-hmm. No, good point, and that's actually how I would finish this section here looking at this. I do think the way Jesus is using the term is in reference to his disciples. He is looking at his disciples. The way he uses that phrase throughout Matthew is applied to them and maybe more specifically to the apostles themselves. But what I notice when I'm looking at these people who have done these things, something that stands out is their lack of concern for who the recipient actually was, because they didn't seemingly understand the full measure of what they were doing. I mentioned the connection with Matthew 10 is that they did it because they were accepting the message from someone. But on another level, they're simply doing this because they have love, because they have kindness, because of what Christ has told them about how to treat your fellow man. And so if we compare this to the rest of Scripture, if we look at this in conjunction with everything else we'd find, you'd see, be at peace with all men, or you'd see, be kind especially to those who are of the household of faith. Don't lack in doing good, especially to those who are of the household of faith. So, no, this would not be justification for teaching, only take care of somebody if he's a Christian. But I think Jesus is using that phrase here to indicate that the importance behind those deeds was especially because you did them for someone who bore my name. You did them for someone who was one of my disciples, someone who came to you in my name. Other things to add there. Jack, go ahead. Yeah, to your point there, in Ephesians 2, a lot of times the reading is stopped maybe at verse 9, and you kind of say, well then, okay, this means it doesn't matter what I do, right? I can just be saved regardless of my behavior, regardless of showing kindness to anyone, exerting myself on behalf of another one, doing anything in the kingdom. But as you point out there, the whole council seems to involve, yeah, why has he put me in this position? Why has he created me to do those good works?
Yeah, and it's not to our glory that we do these good works. It's
right.
To God's glory. He's the one who made us, and he made us for that purpose.
Right.
That's to his glory.
Yeah, which comes back to the root idea of saying, no, I would never argue that those things are what saves us. No, we're going to be saved based on our obedient faith to him, based on the grace that he has given to us. That is what will actually save, but that in no way mitigates the need to respond with that kind of faith and to do what he has made me to do. That involves working on his behalf, working to his glory, not mine. So and that's similar to what we see in Matthew 7, I guess that's not even really a parable, it's just kind of a short story in Matthew 7, the idea of, we've done these great things, we've cast out demons, we've performed all sorts of works in your name, we did something good, but why? You know, to David's point, what was the motive behind that? Why was it being done? Yeah. Anything else there? All right, just a couple of kind of side points. Yeah, go ahead.
There seems to be two separate, and I guess that's what you're getting at too, with all nations and then brethren there in verse 4.
Uh-huh. I think the all nations in verse 32 is just to solidify, to indicate the idea that it's no one escapes judgment. It's going to be there for everyone, because the idea of sheep are being introduced. So, well, maybe he's just talking about the Jews and those who claim to be Jews but aren't, or what? Yeah, which is what that means, I guess. I mean, what that idea actually means literally. But I think the way it's used in verse 32 is just to say, everyone, kind of in the 2 Corinthians 5, we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. It's all going to be there. Then when he is talking about his brethren later on, is just to say, these are the people that you have looked after and why this matters. So, along these lines, we've kind of, this is a little bit in the area of what David just pointed out. Look at those who end up being cursed. What did they do wrong? What's so bad that they're going to be punished for? They go, in verse 46, they go away into everlasting punishment. That's bad. Something is really broken down along the way. They're not getting anything good whatsoever. This is, they're going to go to the place that is prepared for the devil and his angels. They're going into everlasting fire. These must have been some awful people. They must have been the worst of the bunch. So, what does he tell us that they did? We're about to see some heinous things described, right? What he says was, you didn't do anything good. You didn't offer any help. You didn't do good.
It wasn't what they did, it was what they didn't.
Okay. It's very easy to have the do no harm attitude. I haven't done anything bad to anybody. Well, great, but what else? Have you done good for anyone, Jack? Okay. All right. James 1 would have some very clear punch added to that, wouldn't he? All right. So you've got a list of some good things to do here. Am I taking care of those? Do I have an eye to actually do that? Those are things that we really have to think about. This might be one of those areas where Jesus really is setting himself apart from the kind of the commonly accepted religious wisdom of the time. One of the books of the Apocrypha, Tobit, I can't remember what chapter, but kind of an intertestamental Jewish writing, has what almost sounds like a version of the Golden Rule. The things that you hate, do not do that to another man, is that wisdom. That was prolific. That was, you know, something that everyone in his day knew and probably what a lot of people, a lot of Jews of the first century would live by. Don't do something bad to somebody. If you would hate somebody doing that to you, don't do it to them. But what does Jesus say? What's his version of that commandment? What you would want someone to do for you, that you do for them. You do that good thing. Don't just say, I'm not a nuisance to anyone, but actually be vibrant and vital and active, proactive in our service. All right, those two last applications there, pretty simple ideas. I'll just keep talking while the kids are shuffling in. But you've got a judgment that divides in only two groups, almost always. That is almost a 100% biblical constant. When judgment is being described, you don't have three groups. You don't have a lot of shades of gray in between. You go to the right or you go to the left. There's not a door number three. There's not another option given. And that final idea is just that. What Jesus says, how do you show your true feelings towards Christ, your true love for him or lack of, is going to be displayed in your willingness to do the things he calls upon his people to do for each other. How do you treat your fellow man? This goes back to an early idea in Scripture, a Genesis 1 idea in Scripture. Let us create him in our image. Every person in here, every human you encounter is made in the image of God. They bear his image. They were made for that purpose. So how do we treat them? As we would treat the Lord if he were here and do good to him and take care of him and look after him and make sure that his needs are met, or with scorn and hate? All right, I will stop there. We'll let everyone kind of come in and get settled, and then we'll continue on. Thank you very, very much for your time this evening. Always truthfully appreciate that. Thank you.